Thank you once again, ladies and gentlemen, for joining me on this edition of the New York Jazz Workshop podcast. I'm your host, C.J. Shern. Wallace Roney is a nonpareil trumpeter par excellence. Since his debut on records in 1975, and being a part of the New York scene since the 70s, the trumpeter received invaluable tutelage in the bands of Art Blakey, Tony Williams, and Elvin Jones, among many others. He has recorded for Muse, Warner Brothers, and High Note, as well as touring and recording with Herbie Hancock and the VSOP Quintet. He has also presented a stimulating big band of Wayne Shorter compositions, written and originally intended for the second great Miles Davis Quintet of 1965 to 1968. Mr. Roney learned from the great masters of the trumpet, such as Dizzy Gillespie, Clark Terry, and from 1983 to 1991, mentored by his idol, the legendary Miles Davis. Roney participated side by side, sharing solos and parts with Davis during the now classic July 8, 1991 Montreux Jazz Festival concert, with Davis doing something rare in his innovative career, revisiting classic Gil Evans arrangements conducted by Quincy Jones. Roney's respect and admiration for the masters run deep, and in his own quintets, carries on by extending the legacies. Among the lessons Mr. Roney learned were articulation from Clark Terry, and really lessons in playing the ultimate horn from Davis. We discuss Roney's time in the Tony Williams Quintet, which recorded from 1985 to 1991, Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie, and the jazz scene of the 1980s. At Mr. Roney's request, I would like to clarify a point I misstated in the interview. He had come to New York and he was the big young trumpet player along with Wynton Marsalis. As is well known, Mr. Marsalis got major media attention through a massive campaign with Columbia Records. As with sports, competing players sometimes get into bitter rivalries and words fly. In the jazz scene of the 1980s, rivals were made, enemies created, with factions existing on either side. Roney and Marsalis became enemies. Marsalis was soon to begin his massive tenure with Jazz at Lincoln Center, so among the major trumpet players of the era, there was competition seen between Roney, Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard. The young musician saw Marsalis' fame and wanted to hopefully reach that level. Unfortunately, Marsalis, who has stated on numerous occasions he regrets certain remarks he made as a young player, said some pretty disparaging remarks to those he did not agree with, including Roney, and media fracases were created. This is only breaking the surface, and in a future interview this summer, where we discuss Roney's experience with trumpet masters, it would be best to hear it in his words so nothing is lost in translation. Wallace Roney is a wonderful, warm human being, and talking with him for this podcast was a history lesson for me, and I promise our second interview will be just as rich. I thank him enormously for his time, and his quintet will be appearing at the Jazz Forum in Tarrytown, New York from May 24th to 25th, two shows nightly. For more information, contact jazzformarts.org. His latest release on High Note is A Place in Time with Gary Bartz, Ben Solomon, Patrice Rushen, Buster Williams, and Lenny White. Here is my interview with Wallace Roney. Wallace Roney, thank you so much for joining me on the New York Jazz Workshop podcast. I have to say that you have been musician that I've been a fan of for, I'm almost 38 years old, but just about 25 years I've been listening to you.
Oh, thank you very much.
And, you know, no matter what anybody says, you have your own voice and you always bring your own thing. And I've been looking forward to this interview, and finally the opportunity presented itself, and I thought, hey, why don't I give you a ring and see what we could do?
I appreciate that. You know, I almost don't like when people keep saying that I have my own style and all that. It's like they have to defend that all the time instead of just
right.
what it is. You know,
right.
we don't need to, that doesn't need to be discussed anymore unless it's a problem to everybody. And I don't feel that, you know, I don't feel like I have to keep explaining, you know, it's time to just play.
Right.
And let the music speak for itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's either you like what the music or you don't.
Yeah, I think back to something you said in the liner notes of Wallace Roney Quintet on Warner Brothers. You said something to that effect, actually. Let the music speak for itself.
Yeah. Because, I mean, if every time someone interviews me, they have to say that, then obviously that's something that's on their mind all the time. It becomes annoying after a while.
Right.
You know? Just either you like what I play or you don't, and it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of great music out here that needs to be heard, you know, that needs to be recognized. And some people want to like things, and some people aren't.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, you know, that's actually what you just said was something that, you know, whenever I read interviews with you, that's actually something that's bothered me. You know, maybe I should have phrased that a little better, but that's something that's bothered me, that I've read interviews where the interviewers kind of say those things, and then there's been a tendency, you get a little defensive when they mention those things, and yeah, you know, let the music speak for itself. So the first thing I want to ask is, what you been up to now?
I've been up to the same thing I did when I first picked up the trumpet, man. Just trying to keep playing it and trying to master it. And I'm now, you know, I have my band. I've been playing on the scene since 1976. Made my first record, our first recording with somebody in 75. I played with all the great artists, and now, you know, I've taken the lessons that I've learned from those guys and put it to the way I feel I want to try to present or contribute to music, and that's what I've been doing.
Mm-hmm. What was that first record in 1975 that you recorded on?
The first record recording I ever did was on a group called Nation. It was jazz and spoken word from a man named Donnell Lee Haki Mahumbuti, and Nation was the band that was behind them. Yes.
Oh wow! I'll have to check that out.
It's out. I was 15 years old.
Wow. Yeah, because your first record as a leader was Verses, and I think that came out in 1986.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
That's actually one of my favorite albums, and I've been trying to find an actual CD of it, but it's crazy because a lot of the secondhand sellers have it for crazy amounts of money.
Oh, wow. I'm not getting it.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen it for sometimes $60, $70, $80. It's unbelievable, yeah. So, first thing I want to ask you, actually, is about Tony Williams, because I'd like you to tell this story that you told in the podcast you did with Chick Corea, where you were playing with Tony at the Vanguard, and Miles asked you to call him. So, just talk about that story, because when I heard that, I was laughing so hard.
Over to his place. And he said, when you play with Tony tonight, I want you to, when you start your solo, I want you to peck. And he showed me how to peck. I knew how to peck, but I mean, he showed me exactly what he wanted and what he thought I should do.
Right.
Which was a way of, pecking is a way of playing a phrase, but leaving some space in between the phrase.
And
he showed me what he did, what he wanted, and I was bad. So I went on that night, and I started my solos, and I would peck. I would and Tony would get in between the notes, you know. But you didn't do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day, Mom said, how was that? I said, man, that was bad. Then the next night, he said to me, he said, hey, I want you to peck. And after you peck, I want you to play your phrases, but don't end them. Play it off. Finish it at the end of three, or three, or at the end of one. So I would peck, and then I would play longer phrases, but I wouldn't finish it. You know, it's like, instead of making a period, you make a question mark, you know? You know? Or extend the period into to the next question, kind of thing. And, man, when I did that, that made Tony react, too. So then the next night, he said to me, Tony, how's my solo a milestone? Say that. And I said, okay. It was funny because it was like, how do you know I know your solo a milestone? He knew I knew everything he ever did, you know. So I had to think, was I had to think of where I would put what song that would be appropriate that had the chord changes that was similar to milestones or facilitate that.
Right.
Tony had a tune called Arboretum that was actually that it worked on. So I took my solo and after I did all the other stuff still every night on all the songs on Barbarita, it had a break. He went, Bob-a-doo, Bob-a-da-da. And I said, Bob-a-da-da-dee-dee. Tony just cracked up, man. He loved it. So then the last night, Miles said, I used to play this phrase that I play, and when I play it, if I play it straight, it's just part of your solo. It just goes straight through. If I stagger the first one, it means chords. If I stagger both of them, it's drum solo. So he showed me how to do all three ways. The phrase goes.
Yeah.
But he showed me how to phrase it, what it means, each of the things. So. Yeah, so now, the last one, on Friday night, I'm up there, I'm doing all the stuff he told me, I'm playing Milestone, and then on Up Temple Tune, at the end of my solo, I said, I staggered both of them, and Tony immediately went to a jump, and then he stopped, and and the audience laughed too, they like, everybody was in on a joke. You know?
Yeah.
And then we just played the song on out. And Tony said, Wally, don't do that. Don't do that, because if you do that, I gotta do this, so don't do it. Which he really meant do it, so that became part of what we did.
Yeah, because...
And then I spoke to Miles, he said, how was it? And man, he just cracked up before I could even answer, because he knew. So definitely. But that was what was going on. Then I was hanging with Miles Davis. I was fortunate to be able to hang with the genius of the 21st century and afterwards, you know, and learn these lessons from them, you know. Like one time I went over his house. It's funny because I was going with Tony to Canada. We were playing Canada, and we usually leave a day early. That's what you should do anyway. And leave restaurants, and then you couldn't get it the next day. But this, as we were getting ready to leave that morning, I got a call from Mom. What you doing? I said, nothing. I was supposed to get, I got a gig, leaving for my gig in a couple hours. He said, come over real quick. So I came over, and I called my Tony Williams' manager, Marianne Topper. And I said to Marianne, look, I'm going over to Miles' place. I don't know if I told her I was going to Miles' place, but I asked her, could I change my ticket to go to Canada? Because obviously, if I was going to go over there, I wasn't going to be able to make the plane. Mm-hmm. So at them days, you could change your ticket. You know what I mean? You could change it, boom, no problem. Catch the next flight or whatever. It was no problem. So Marianne said, yeah, we'll change your ticket. So I go over to Miles' place, and we're just sitting around in the dark, not really saying much, you know. He might have said one or two things, you know. He might have said something like, Triad in second inversion is a beautiful stuff, great sound, something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't say much, and I'm just sitting there. So then he looks at me, and he said, what time is your gig? When do you leave for your gig? I said, well, I'm supposed to leave at 7. So he picks up his coat and his keys, and he's like, hey, you gonna give me a ride? I think he thought I was gonna play the Vanguard or something. I said, I gotta go to the airport. I forgot how this went. He said, where is it? I said, well, I'm going to Toronto. That's what it was. He looked at me and said, what? You better get going. I told him, I said, I'll tell you, I'm going to leave tomorrow. He's like, okay. So, but anyway, I had to get ready to go anyway. So as I was leaving, we were walking out the door. He said, yeah. And he gave me this case. And it had the blue Martin Caridi trumpet in it. I was like, oh, man. So I took that thing for and I got on the plane. And I got to Canada. The next day, and Tony was in the dressing room, and everybody's getting ready to get go on stage, but Tony's in the dressing room,
mm-hmm.
And I come up in the dressing room, I pull out my horn, and Tony sees that blue and green trumpet, he said, you've been hanging with Dave. That was so cool, man. That was too cool. And then I walked on stage, and he had my son. He got a blue trumpet. He got a green trumpet. Because it looked green sometimes, it looked blue, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, your time where Miles mentored you from 1983 up until he died was one of the most unbelievable times that I think that I've ever heard of a musician, you know, getting tutored, and the lessons that he taught you, I would imagine, are, we could probably go on for hours about those, but you've also been mentored by Art Blakey, you played with the Messengers, you played with Papa Joe Jones, well,
I never played with Papa Joe Jones.
Right, you were
Philly Joe Jones.
Philly Joe, right, you were mentored by Papa Joe to an extent, right? Oh, right.
No, but I would say this, though, before you go any further. You know, it was an honor at the time, and it's an honor in my life and the rest of my life that I got the chance to hang with Miles Davis, because he was my idol.
Yeah.
And from when I was studying music, at the time when I came to New York, I was, you know, there was other people who was popular, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying nobody deserves, everybody deserves everything, you know? Wynton Marsalis was popular. And everything that was going with Wynton that was in that crew, you know, from New Orleans, that was a popular thing. And
yeah.
he had a lot of good players too, you know. And I was really trying, but it seemed like, you know, you either had to be in this camp, in the other camp, you were the enemy, and, you know?
Mm-hmm,
I don't think Miles knew about any of this stuff. All he heard was, his, you know, he was doing what he was doing, and he heard me.
Yeah.
And he said he heard something in my plane, and that was a blessing because it helped me. He saw something in me where the business was so focused on trying to be, you know, focused on the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
It helped me, let's put it like that. It was great that you didn't feel like your efforts were going in vain because I had, you know, what, Miles was my hero, but I had studied all the great trumpet players. I studied everybody because you have to study. If you love this music, you have to understand what happened and how to use what they did. You know, people, I hear people now saying you shouldn't this and that. What Miles taught me was, don't worry about what people say or trying to get your own thing. You're going to have your own thing because you're you.
You're right.
You know,
right.
Study everything you can and try to learn as much as you can and serve the music. And your sensibility is going to come out because you're going to hear things that your idols do different than what they do.
Mm-hmm.
The way they hear it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you've got to learn everything, you know, and that was, you know, that was the way I was taught, and that was a more honest way than trying to say, well, I'm going to be an innovator. I don't think anybody that was an innovator said they were going to be an innovator.
Right,
they just,
right.
They just did what they did. That the other way is pretentious, in my opinion. That doesn't mean my opinion is the only opinion that matters.
Well, I like something that you said was that you just said that, you know, Miles never thought of anything as like the enemy or anything, those camps, because back in the 80s, there was that kind of faction going on with the Wynton Marsalis and all those others. Yeah, Papa Joe Jones. Actually, what I was thinking about was you had seen Max Roach at a club and
right.
Papa Jones was behind the scenes kind of pantomiming stuff.
Right. Yeah, the week before, Max Roach was playing at the 7th Avenue South with his band, and the tickets were like $100. I'm exaggerating, but you know,
yeah,
and it was a lot of money.
Right.
And then after that week was over, on a Wednesday they had the club on 117th Street, Columbia. That Max wrote that Papa Joe played every Wednesday.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this particular Wednesday, Papa Joe was too sick to perform.
Mm-hmm.
So then you go up there, and who was there but Max Roach? Max was there playing for Papa Joe. It was just solo drums up. Max had his drums in the lid. And Papa Joe was there with Max, pantomiming while Max played. And then as he would pantomime, then he would point to a part of the drum.
Mm-hmm.
And Max would have to play the drum like this. He would point to the hi-hat. And Max would have to play the hi-hat, you know. And then Papa Joe would pantomime. Then Papa Joe would point to the bass drum. And Max would play the bass drum, you know. But Max would be taking these great solos, you know. And that was great. The whole thing, as you were saying, with the 80s and Wynton, it'll... No disrespect to any of the musicians, Wynton included, but these were fantastic musicians.
Oh, yeah.
It was just what I'm saying was, at the time, whether it was media made or whether it was competition made,
mm-hmm.
and it was competition. Now, let's not, you know, because we had our fights, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But it became... You either like this guy, and if you like him, and you were an enemy of that, you weren't getting anything. And the press act like that, everybody act like that. It
mm-hmm.
was kind of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's part of life. And maybe even at that point, you know, everything is supposed to happen the way it's supposed to happen. I realize that when you're young, you don't understand. You think everything is owed to you.
Yeah.
Nothing is owed to you except for what you gain.
Right.
And that's not even owed to you. You know, that's what you work for.
Mm-hmm.
You
know. And a point that you also made before too about listening to everybody, I think that's so important because as a young jazz fan and aficionado myself, I think it's so important to listen to everybody because I find that I talk to some people who are like my age and they don't know the history. They don't know the history of the trumpet. Like, you ask them about Roy Eldridge, they don't know who that is.
Right. The more they'll seek it. You know, the further you get, the more you want to find more about. I used to hear people say the kids don't know this, the kids don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that's you still find your way. It, the music is there,
right?
You know,
right.
And that's the beauty of it. Roy left is there for eternity and beyond.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So you know there's Roy Elbridge, there's Bobby Moore that people don't know, but they'll find them. And Freddie Webster, Buddy Anderson, Frankie Newton.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
Some great musicians out there, you know, and of course, Dizzy, because he was Dizzy.
Mm.
And you understand how great these guys are, the better you get. The more what you've done becomes less important, and the more you want to incorporate and understand what happened, so you can take it further. You don't want to do what they do, though, and just start playing it like, say, I learned a little bit. Yeah, you want to learn it and then see how you can incorporate it into your newer ideas, you know? And you might find out what your new ideas ain't really that new, but it doesn't mean anything. Take it. Keep doing it anyway.
Right, right. You know? Actually, it makes me think of something where we're both boxing fans, too. And there's a lot of people who think that Floyd Mayweather's style, for example, was a totally new thing. But no, you got to go back to video or film from the 20s and 30s
to see he incorporated that.
Yeah.
You know, even if they don't even want to go that far, his father was doing that in the 80s,
right.
Floyd Senior was fighting that way. Floyd Senior was a heck of a fighter.
Oh yeah, yeah. I want to ask you about the connections between jazz and boxing in a bit, but you mentioned Dizzy, and I want to talk about Dizzy for a second because I just actually bought that box set of his last recordings that was made several years ago, and. Talk about that week that you played with Dizzy and Claudio Roditi, because there's some great stuff on that.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I knew Dizzy since I was 12. That's when I first met him.
Wow.
And Dizzy was like he was another man. He's like my grandfather.
Yeah,
Was my father. Dizzy was my grandfather, and Clark was my uncle. And I learned from those three. I actually knew them before I knew Miles. I idolized Miles while I knew them, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But I actually personally knew Dizzy. So when they put that thing together, Dizzy asked for me to be part of it. And it was, I think I might have played with him. I played with Dizzy so much before that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the capper to it. And the two songs they used, you know, we played a whole set. They didn't use the best stuff. They didn't. They just used stuff that they felt fit the record. But the best stuff is left off the record.
I kind of figured.
Yeah, man. We were going at it, boy.
and Dizzy was really cooking at that stuff, too. He could still pull some of the stuff that he pulled off, you know, like when he was young. And it was some great stuff. I loved those records.
But I'll tell you, at that point, Dizzy was what? Almost 80 or something like
that? He was 74. He was turning 75.
Okay, 77. Okay. Wow. And he, of course, he could still play all that stuff, but he was content now to let his disciples Everyone that played modern trumpet is a disciple of Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah.
Everyone that plays the modern trumpet. So this was now all his children, and he let us go ahead and play, and occasionally he'll say, okay, and he'll play his thing. He didn't have to cut us, but I'll tell you a funny story. One day I played with Dizzy in Washington, D.C. in Blues Alley.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, for a whole week. And the first night I was playing, you know, I remember Dizzy said to me, where you get that stuff from? And I said, what? And he said, I said, I got it from you, Bert. He said, no, I said, Bert, I got this from you. You know, because the stuff, it was his stuff, but it might have been through a mild filter. But anyway, I got it from you. So anyway, Dizzy would say to me, so we played the second night, and we played some more, and I'm going for it. About the fourth night, she says to me, we played Manitoba. So Dizzy says to me, so we played Manitoba. And then, so now, I never feel like I'm playing more than Dizzy, but I'm getting more confident. So one night, I take a solo on Manitoba, and I explode out of the set. I just explode. And Dizzy looked at me. He says, "Oh, you want to play, huh?" So I said, "Yeah, okay." So the next night, I took the solo, and he came behind me and played so. He became young Dizzy. We both laughed. He laughed, I laughed. What was nothing I could do behind that, man? There was nothing I could do.
That kind of reminds me of when Joey DeFrancesco and Jimmy Smith played. They had their historic summit. And some things Joey was playing, you know, Jimmy would start playing some stuff, and Jimmy would, like, sound like, you know, what he was playing in, like, 1957. It was that same kind of thing. Oh, yeah.
Nobody could play that.
All right.
I wasn't that lucky. You know what I mean?
So, all the experience that you've had playing with the legends like Art Blakey and Dizzy and Miles and Tony Williams, in terms of the jazz education system today and how it's framed, how would you say jazz education is now compared to those lessons you learned, you know, on the road and in the shed, so to speak?
When I grew up, they didn't have jazz education. We had music education, which was really good. Because you learn music and you learn the discipline of playing an instrument. We didn't learn licks and phrases and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Where you learned that was by going to the masters, and you would go and you'd watch them play. You sit right up under them. They might let you sit in, you know, and gauge yourself next to what they're doing, what is good, what's up to the level or not. And then they would play things that would be amazing, and you might ask them how to do it. A lot of times they would show you, a lot of times they wouldn't show you. They'd be like, man, that's my stuff. That's my secret, you know. That's how I'm going to kick your butt with. And it was up to you to figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't do it. But a lot of times they would, you know, you would be, you know, jam sessions. Today, they got a lot of musicians teaching, and it's a good thing. What I think happens is they learn in licks instead of learning music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it should go back to learning music. And then, and you can still learn, I think learning in school is a thing too, don't get me wrong.
Right.
But I still think the most important thing is you got to be around the masters.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Now, the problem we have about being around the masters is today, they'll say, well, the masters are all gone. But that's not true.
Because, right, exactly.
Yeah, because when Coleman Hawkins was alive, you know, the people that like Coleman Hawkins would have said the same thing about Wow.
Mm-hmm,
they were
mm-hmm.
down at Coleman Hawkins and Roy Eldridge and all the gone. You see? So the musician, Marco is gone now, but, you know, all of us that carry on from that, we have the responsibility of being those people, you know, however we choose to do it, you know? You know, that we have definitely played with, we're the link of what happened, you know, to the people like Art Blakey and McCoy, who's still alive, you know, and Tony and Miles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are the ones that look them in the eye.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, you know, but the media, for some reason, don't want us to be viewed that way.
Right, right.
So they put that kind of thing out there. And the musician should be smart enough to understand that themselves. But the way they have it now, they got young guys out here making gigs that never did anything.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So why does they listen to us?
Right.
You know, but the truth of it is, if it's true or not, that they should listen to us because they love the music so. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and just talking to you right now is an education for me because I had the wonderful pleasure of doing an interview with Lenny White this past summer, and he came up to my apartment, and we talked for about an hour and a half, man. It was beautiful. And it's like talking to you guys is just incredible for me because as a student of this music, I'm learning something I can't learn from the history books. I can't learn this from the liner notes. I can't learn this from the so-called media people. You know,
right.
It's a.
Let me put it like this. I told you I made my first recording at 15 years old.
Yeah.
When I did that, you know, everybody was saying, "Wow. This little boy, he's
15
years old, and he's playing like Lee Morgan and all that kind of
Yeah,
stuff.
Exactly, right.
Oh, man, it was, you know, and that was flattering to me. Don't get me wrong. I was not delusional to believe that I should be, you know, that now I need to go to the Village Vanguard and leave my own band.
Yeah, right, right.
My whole goal was, yeah, man, I'm trying to play like Lee Morgan at my Miles Davis, my hero, but I want to play with Art Blakey.
Mm-hmm,
measure up, you know what I mean? And do what Lee Morgan did, do what Miles did, do it. That was what I was thinking at 15. I felt that way all the way up until I was 25 years old and made my first record.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like, you know, I mean, Johnny Coles was out here playing while I was 15 years old.
Wow.
If anyone deserved a record deal, Johnny Coles, you know.
Exactly, exactly.
And so I was smart enough to know that. I wasn't forced on me that, oh, you're this and you know, you need to go out. And people were telling me that, by the way. Oh, man, people were telling me all kinds of stuff. But I was smart enough to understand, oh, man, I want to be part of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's okay that y'all say that, but I want Art Blakey to say that.
Yeah.
I want to say that, you know. I want McCoy to tell me that, you know. It was one of the honors of my life, because McCoy told me, They said, man, you know, you got a great responsibility out here, man, Oscar Peterson. So those are the things that make me, give me my credibility to say that, you know. But that's what I seeked out. That's what I was doing instead of just trying to be cute, you know, or, you know, and that's what I think about the scene and the young musicians and education and all that. You know what you need to do.
Yeah, and like what you just said about getting that validation from musicians.
Right.
Like when Lenny told me, you know, CJ, you got your stuff together as a fan of this music, that just meant the world to me, because this is one of the all-time greats that I've been listening to since I was a kid. And it's just, you know, it's great. And, you know, before we close, I just want to ask you briefly about the Wayne Shorter project, and also what are the connections between jazz and boxing, do you think? Because so many jazz fans are also boxing fans.
Oh, man. I don't know if there's the connection. Well, okay. The real connection is black people.
Right.
And who we are.
Yeah.
Jazz, before the avant, the event of modern jazz, they thought black people were, what, three-fifths human? They could never do anything sophisticated.
Right.
Wasn't smart people. You know, we just came out of slavery and still would have been slaves if Lincoln didn't need black people to help fight in the war, you know. If, you know, the whole thing. So the music that we made was very simplistic and all that, and you'll see where it comes with boxing. And white superiority or maybe global superiority over blacks, whatever it was, they thought. And then all of a sudden, boxing is a way, first of all, boxing is a very intelligent sport.
Yeah.
Although, now I'm not, I've boxed since I was 10 years old.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, right.
I kind of don't like it anymore, to be honest. But I'll explain that, too. But it's a very intelligent sport. I love it as a martial art. That's what I love it as a defense and martial arts. But it helps you develop your body and what your body can do, control over yourself, control, you know. And that wasn't the dominion of a people that's only three. Human, you know? Well, the people that were oppressing them by knocking them out, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
So jazz, modern jazz, did the same thing, because now, whereas before, early jazz was a great improvisational music, but to be honest, it wasn't on the same level technically as a lot of the classical music, or European classical music, because that term classical, they gave it that term. You know, because a lot of the music that was written by a lot of the European masters, say, it took a great deal of technical discipline. But now, all of a sudden, you got Charlie Parker developing his instrument like Peggy. You got Art Tatum playing the piano, and Horowitz is saying, and Arthur Rubinstein is saying, God's in the house.
Yeah, right.
You know, he's playing stuff on the trumpet that now the classical musicians have to say, that's impossible to play. They have dexterity.
Yeah.
All this coming from three-fifths of a human, supposedly. See, if you're three-fifths of a human, you weren't supposed to have that kind of understanding or ability to do this. Well, jazz musicians showed that you can have that kind of dexterity and the kind of mind to create somatic improvisation, chorus after chorus, just like Mozart did, and it would take Mozart months to do, you see?
Right.
Just boxing and jazz, if you really want to know. Now, other than that, it's the appreciation of seeing people do something. So it is the rhythmic timing. Boxing and jazz, definitely, especially up to the 70s, I would say. I think the best days of boxing, either by the element of timing and improvisation.
Sure.
Knowledge and improvisation. Jazz musicians did. And they were, it was no coincidence that they were listening to jazz. You know, when they were training, when they were working out at the speed bag, reflex bag, they were listening to jazz, you know.
Yeah.
And Max was playing all these syncopated beats, and they're doing their jazz with it. Boom, 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 bam, you know what I mean? So they're thinking like that. But I tell you, with all that said and done, and I love it, like I said, I've boxed since I was 10. I saw the movie Django, a fictional movie, of course.
Right.
But it really rang something to me. It made me kind of rethink my whole feelings about boxing. Because as you remember, there's a scene where two brothers had to kill themselves. Had to fight to death for the amusement of those slave owners.
Yeah.
Or their capturers, whatever you want to call them. And if you didn't kill the other guy, you were going to get killed. And when I looked at that, I said, you know, we had to beat each other up for this entertainment of these people. That's not right. You know?
Right.
How much I love the art of it. That's why I say I love it as a martial art. But I'm not sure I love it anymore for the spectator. You know, Muhammad Ali, I really loved. I'll tell you why. Muhammad Ali was beautiful in the ring.
Oh, yeah.
But you ever see after he knocked someone out, what he'd do? He'd go over to the guy and pick him up.
Yeah.
Say, are you okay?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Mike Tyson would do that, too, in his early fights.
Right, you know what I mean? Are you okay?
Yeah.
You know, they had to do this, but they also wanted to make sure you were okay. And that's more humane, that I'm going to kill you. And even if you didn't mean to kill them, the intention that we're looking at somebody get destroyed for amusement, that's why I don't think I'm not with that anymore. But I am with the art of boxing.
Yeah.
You know, because I've learned so much about, and you develop so many things within boxing, that I use, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, what you just said, it made me think about, I've actually thought about some of those same things, and I practice a form of Japanese esoteric Buddhism, and as a Buddhist, I've thought about, hey, should I really be, you know, watching these guys do
right.
this?
Right.
And I've really thought about that in terms of the Shinyoen philosophy of Buddhism, and, you know, is that something that should be, but yeah, you're right. But in terms of the art, like, I listen to Roy Haynes, and I can see Sugar Ray Robinson, I see Joe Frazier, I can hear Elvin Jones and Jack DeJohnette, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 So it's the, you know, it's the art of the thing that counts. Now, the whole Wayne Shorter project, was there supposed to be an album coming out of Legend and Twin Dragons, or?
It's Legend, Universe, Twin Dragons, and a 5/4 tune. And then Wayne asked me to record the theme of this movie, Adelia Sayre, because that was the last arrangement he wrote for Lee Morgan before Lee Morgan died.
Wow.
Yeah, and he didn't get to give it to Lee because, as you know, Lee died because of Adelia Sayre.
Yeah.
And then he also asked me to do an arrangement of Devil May Care, because that was his first solo with Miles.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, we went and we recorded these things, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, we recorded all of them, yeah.
Is there a timetable to when those things may be out?
Fine, we we're trying to find a way to put it out. You know, no companies have been interested in it. You know?
Wow, okay.
Now, I'm sure if someone else recorded it, they probably would be interested in it. You know?
Yeah, you know, I'm surprised Blue Note's not biting on it.
Right, maybe if somebody else did it, they would. It's like, you know, whatever that is, Wayne gave it to me, so mm-hmm. they just...
That's quite an honor, and we could have a whole nother conversation on that too. But you'll be playing at the Jazz Forum with your quintet later this month, and I'm going to be coming down that Friday night to see you.
Right.
And it's going to be a real pleasure meeting you too, because I've wanted to meet you in person and just talk to you for a long time.
Oh, very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, and I don't think finding a guy in a purple wheelchair is going to be a very hard thing to do. So
say that again. I didn't mean to say that again.
I don't think finding a guy in a purple wheelchair is going to be a very hard thing to do.
Oh, okay. Oh, in a wheelchair. Oh, okay. That's cool.
Yeah.
All right, we'll see you.
Yeah. Well, you know something you said about the 3/5 human thing in relation to black people. I'm a half black myself, but being a person with a cerebral palsy, a disability, I've kind of felt like the 3/5 human thing myself in life. Like, just to give the people a little bit of personal information, I've been living on my own now for 3 years since my mom died, and you know, I'm just really proving to society that I can, you know, be a part of it.
Right.
And yeah.
You're proving it. You can accomplish anything.
Yeah, and just being a fan of jazz music ever since I was out of the womb, practically, has been just a blessing. And,
oh, that's beautiful. Me too. That was the same way.
Yeah, you know, the first Miles record I heard, the first Miles record I had was ESP at 5 years old.
Beautiful.
And the second one was Someday My Prince Will Come. And that record taught me everything I know. I need to know about a brush to sticks transition on the title track.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, well, you know what's really funny? You said you had ESP at 5 years old.
Yeah.
I had ESP at 5 years old. But the difference between me and you was I had ESP at 5 years old when it came out.
Right.
In 1965, I was 5 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what's funny too, Wallace, is we're both Gemini too.
Oh yeah, when's your birthday?
June 20th.
Oh, great. My son is June 14th.
Wow, that's incredible. So I just want to thank you so much for your time. It's been absolutely wonderful.
Thank you very much.
For the New York Jazz Workshop Podcast, I'm your host, CJ Shern. Peace, love, groove, and keep swinging, everybody.